Silence.
Oppenheimer.
I think they're talking about us. No way.
I myself am strange and unusual.
This is Nerf Ray Radio.
Nerd alert!
These nerds are a threat to our way of life.
See, this is the stuff that brings nerds together.
So it's sort of social. Demented and sad, but social, right?
If I'm interested in it, then by definition, it is nerdy.
Are you in loser denial or something?
I'm a nerd, and I'm pretty proud of it.
My dad's a nerd.
And welcome to episode 196 of Nerd Pride Radio. 196, awesome number. I love 196 because, all right, first off, it's roughly 200. It's about 200, but it's also 14 squared, which makes it kind of nice when you're laying out grids, setting up games, stuff like that. A 14 by 14 works really well. I love 196. But more than that, I just watched a video from Numberphile. Numberphile is a YouTube channel I subscribe to. And the video was entitled, What's So Interesting About 196? Turns out that, according to them, the most interesting thing about it is the smallest potential Lestrel number. I know, I had no idea what that was either. What you do is you pick any number at all, and then you reverse the number, just reverse the order of the digits, and then add it to the original number. So if you started with 89, you would then add that to 98, and then you'd get a resulting number. And then you repeat this process until the answer turns out to be a palindrome. And a Lestrel number is a number that we don't think ever becomes a palindrome. But what we don't know for sure, because there's no way in base 10 of proving whether or not it's going to end. I mean, look, if you get an answer and you find out that, you know, you get a palindrome, okay, you're done. That one's clearly not a Lestrel number. But for the number 196, it's the smallest number that they've tried this on that they can't find an answer yet. And this is after literally reverse the digits, add it together. Oh, that didn't work. Okay, now reverse these digits, add it together. Okay, let's do it again. They've done it literally billions of times. Billions.
What?
Billions. And they still, after billions of iterations of this, they still have no answer. So 196 is the smallest possible Lestrel number. There you go. I thought it was fascinating. You guys, seriously, if you like numbers like I do, or even if you like numbers a little bit, you don't have to like them the way I do. That's kind of, it's a little intense sometimes. You should subscribe to Numberphile. Numberphile is a really great mathematics-based YouTube channel, and I really enjoy it. So there you go. So ask me how I'm doing today. Go on, ask me.
How are you doing today?
Well, thank you, Noam. I am awesome. My name is Mike Jones. I am a D&D slash Pathfinder nerd, a history nerd, a sci-fi nerd, a comic book nerd, computer nerd, movie nerd, comedy nerd, science nerd, gaming nerd, plus... there's like seven other kinds of nerd. I only wish I was nerdy enough to be. You are listening to Nerd Pride Radio, the place I go every week to haver on about all the nerd stuff that just won't fit in my skull anymore. As always, you're listening to the best-smelling podcast on the internet. That's right. Nerd Pride smells exactly like my Gen Con-induced adrenaline. I am so pumped. All right, and with me is my son Noah. Say hi, Noah. Yeah, Noah's awesome. All right. You know what? Before we get to the meticulously planned portion of this podcast, let's do a little meta talk.
Oppenheimer!
That's right. Meta talk's just where I pull back the curtain a little bit, talk about the podcast, talk about the website stuff going on. Oh, I'm sorry. Pull back the curtain, open the kimono, a little bit inside baseball. That's what meta talk is. And actually, this is just a reminder. I could have done this in updates, but I did meta talk. We are watching Adventures in Babysitting this month. In fact, we already watched Adventures in Babysitting, and we would have talked about it tonight, but Aiden is not here. So, we will be talking about Adventures in Babysitting in our Awesome in the 80s segment next week. So, if you guys have any feedback, any opinions on Adventures in Babysitting, good or bad, go ahead and fill us in ahead of time. We'll include it as part of that. We'll get your comments. I can't say anything about it. Never mind. I was going to ramble on a little bit, but we did watch it, and it's going to be a good show. So that'll be next week. And then that's it. Meticulously plotted portion of the podcast. This is the time for me when I talk about whatever has been on my mind for the last week. If something strikes me as interesting during the course of my busy, busy week, I add it to my master list, and the very best stuff off of that list gets spewed out all over you guys every week when I record. You lucky dogs.
Not so lucky dogs, I should say.
No way. This stuff is awesome. This is.
Well, it's getting spewed, so that's kind of gross.
That's just how I present things. It wells up in me, and then I can't contain it anymore. I am like a sprinkler full of nerd information, and it just chunk, 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 chunk all over everybody. That's all I can do. Sorry. All right. So, first up on my master list, it's my gaming table.
I've got Dungeon Master's Guide. I've got 12-sided die.
Role-playing games, video games, board games, card games, any games. If it fits on my gaming table, then I am here to share it with you. First up, Laser Riders. Just letting you know, we've been playing some Laser Riders, and it rocks. So, who won today, Noah?
Me!
Noah.
With the most beautiful thing that happened. I broke most of my track.
And?
And then I stole my brother's prism.
Yes.
And then I did a sweet three light speed shallow turn into another.
Yep. He was pulling what he called the sneaky snake because
the snecky snake, Dad.
It was like Eli was just running away with this game, just running away with it, and he was lined up perfectly and it just barely missed. And so while Eli is trying to recover, Noah, I mean, going slow motion almost the entire way, he never put it up into high gear. He wound up just kind of winding back and forth, stole one out from under Eli, and everything else just kind of lined up perfectly. And he took it away from him. It was pretty cool. So we had a good time. Now, this is how jaded my kids are. We get done playing this game, and Eli brought over a couple of friends. So it was Eli and Noah, and then two friends that Eli's playing, who had never encountered Laser Riders before. So, and they were stoked. It was so awesome. And we get done with the game, and I posted up pictures of them playing, and then a picture of the board. And I posted that up on Facebook, and talked about how awesome Laser Riders is, and mentioned, by the way, we played it on a kidney-shaped table, so it was all sorts of curved surfaces, which was really unusual, and it made for an interesting setup. It was really cool. And so I posted that out on Facebook.
They recommend a circular table.
Yeah, always try something funny. It's really cool. All right, so anyway, I posted it out, and then Nicole, who is one of the designers, made a response back, and so we had a little back and forth talking about it, and she thought it was really awesome that they were playing, and said it looked great and all this. And so I show the other kids that, hey, look, guys, I posted your picture up and the person who designed this game has already commented on it. And Eli's friends are like, oh, yeah, all right. I mean, like, that didn't impress them. I mean, look, my kids, yeah, they know I've known Tony and Nicole for a while and that, you know, we've played lots of their games and that we really enjoy their work. And so, to Eli and Noah, no big surprise, but to their friends, it was like, all right. Yeah, oh, man. You know what? Wasted on these kids, because that's cool stuff, darn it. Oh, man. But that was Laser Riders, which I've been talking about ad nauseum. And again, if you haven't bought Laser Riders, you can buy it. Go do a search. In fact, they just featured it in Think Geek this week. ThinkGeek.com has Laser Riders up there, and I'm so happy for them. I am really could not be happier for these two. This is really cool. I mean, they are young, newly married game designers who I think have spectacular ideas and great games, and I'm glad to see them being successful with it. They've put themselves out there, and it's working for them, and it couldn't be happier. So, the other thing I had, and this is still on my gaming table, role-playing games, I was thinking about, and this is going to be repeating some stories I've already told you guys over the years of this podcast. Do you realize I've been doing this for like 6 years? Something like that? Weird. But looking at the Talos Deep adventure, that's the intense trap-filled goblin dungeon, an adventure for Dungeons & Dragons that was in Dungeon Magazine years and years ago. And I talked about it last week where my brother Kyle had finally found these old issues, and I located this adventure, and it brought back all this nostalgia. And I was thinking about Talos Deep as this turning point for me in my role-playing career. And I was thinking about the things that I learned from it and how it changed me. And I thought, well, okay, what other turning points have there been for me in role-playing? And these will probably, to some degree, mirror other people's experiences. But I just hit the high points of my role-playing stuff, and it's always stories. First, when we were 12 years old and just trying out Redbox Dungeons & Dragons, and we moved very quickly Redbox, Bluebox, and then realized that, oh, wait, AD&D was way better. And so
AD&D?
I'm sorry. AD&D was Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. So that was originally there was just Dungeons & Dragons, and then they put out the Redbox Dungeons & Dragons is how it's referred to now.
Yeah.
And the Redbox was like the basic version. It was an intro version. So instead of being like a dwarf cleric, you were just a dwarf. That was your race and your class.
Yeah.
And so all dwarves had the same sorts of abilities. All elves were fighter magic user combinations. All halflings did the, you know. And it was a very simplified version of Dungeons & Dragons in a lot of ways. And that's what we started on. But then Advanced Dungeons & Dragons was also out. And Advanced Dungeons & Dragons was, you know, where you could do all the combinations of races and classes. And there was still a lot of really stupid stuff in it. But, it was the game that got us hooked. And it was really awesome. And in that first campaign we played, the first turning point we had was as we raced through adventure and everyone leveled up way too quickly and they were loaded up with power. And this is, we always remind ourselves of, hey, remember the time when we beat the Platinum Dragon? Yeah, that was awesome. And it's always in a sarcastic tone because that was the culmination of our first D&D adventure. I mean, look, just figuring out what role-playing was the first time was like a lightning bolt. I mean, I guess that would be my first one. It's just discovering that role-playing existed and realizing that you could tell this free-form story and that there's, you know, with the dice and the books and there's guidelines for it, but you can do anything you want. That's still the most amazing thing when I have the rare opportunity to introduce somebody new, completely fresh to role-playing games, who doesn't have any idea what's going on, and they get into it, and it's that dawning realization of, oh my god, I could do anything. This is, oh my god, it's anything. It's really cool. So that was probably the first, but when I was game master, dungeon master at that time, and the team, I mean, they were on a mission to create a potion of immortality, and I decided that one of the ingredients was going to be the brains of the Platinum Dragon, which did not bother them to slaughter this near godlike being, and then apparently consume his brains. And it was after that one that, I mean, they had no right, you know, in any world does anyone have there's no way they should have been able to do this. But, you know, we were kids. We were stupid. We'd never played before. And so we did that Monty Hall sort of thing where they just get way too much power way too fast. And as a game master, I didn't know how to temper that or control it, or even didn't even realize that I needed to. Well, that was the turning point. After they beat the Platinum Dragon, and it was like, okay, well, there's nowhere really to go after this with these characters. There's no reason to continue playing. And that was my realization that, oh, you know what? Maybe there's a pacing and a structure to this stuff. That was my learning experience there. And the next sets of games we played, it was all dungeon crawling, and it was all, I mean, there was no role playing as in actually playing characters. I mean, they were basically just stats on a page that did really cool stuff, and they would stumble from room to room in a dungeon and, you know, defeat this creature or solve this puzzle or whatever it was and then move on. There was no actual story to it, which was fine. We had a great time playing that, but that was learning the pacing and learning, the magic of slower advancement, the learning, touch point there is that, oh, look how much cooler it is when they feel like they've actually earned something. And that was it. And it was, we did that for a long time. It was really, really cool. But then my next step up would be when we finally started actually having characters that we cared about. And that was, a lot of that was when I played with, my brother Kyle and then my best friend Steve back at the time. And Steve and Kyle, they were my only two players. And for the longest time, they were Steve was a halfling thief and Kyle was a dark elf cleric. And it was a spectacular story. I mean, they were best friends and partners, and they had this, they had a great story that was developing, and there was actual plot involved, and it was still a lot of, you know, solve the puzzle of the week or defeat this particular creature or whatever. And the challenges sometimes didn't really tie together. But actually learning to tell a story was really cool. And that was also for me, during that time, one of the greatest things I learned is that as a dungeon master, as a game master, I don't always have to know where things are going. I don't always have to have a plan or a solution, that I don't always have to plot out exactly where things are going to go. Because,
like,
go ahead.
Just like our first run, Dad, you were like, oh, they're never going to escape this place for a long while.
Yes.
And we escaped.
Yes. And you guys were brilliant. And that was, yes, that's exactly the lesson. That's exactly that.
You never know what your characters are going to do. Like, and we aren't going to do this main story plot you had.
That's exactly right. You guys went off through, literally through a secret side door, and then
inside a wall while our friend.
Yes, and then completely turned everything. I thought you guys were going to lead a slave revolt and that there'd be this big battle and all this stuff going on. And now you guys weren't having any of that. You're like, no, screw these other guys. We're sneaking out of here because we got better things to be doing. And so when that happened.
Goodbye, crybaby.
That's right. Hey, crybaby came back to, well, not kick your butts, but still, be a thorn in your side for a while. And when that happened for the first time with Kyle and Steve in that early game, it was a side quest out of another dungeon magazine. And in this side quest, you go into a temple, and this temple, you wind up being locked in, and there is absolutely no way out unless you wind up, you have to go behind the altar, and then there's levers to pull, and you find this secret thing, and then if you do the ceremony exactly correctly, then the doors will open back up. But it was this like 4 or 5 step puzzle process that just as I looked at it, I'm like, well, there is no way they're ever going to figure this out. So let's just see what happens. And, you know, if I have to give them some clues, I'll give them some clues. But otherwise, it's built to be an impenetrable trap. It's built so that you shouldn't be able to get out of it unless you follow these steps exactly. And yet, and I wish I had written it down, recorded something at the time, because I don't even remember how they got out of it. I just remember it had something to do with the place did have light coming in from some kind of skylight window, and it was way up high, and there shouldn't have been any way to get to it. And even if you could, you shouldn't have been able to do anything with it. And yet they worked within what was given to them, and they found this way out that amazed me, just floored me that they even thought of it, much less that I'm like checking the book. And I'm like, okay, here's what it says it is. Here's where they can go. And oh, well, crap, that'll work. And I mean, and it did. And, you know, and it took a couple of lucky dice rolls and this kind of stuff. But it was, the idea was I put them into an inescapable trap, and then they escaped anyway, because that's what players do. And that was the moment I realized that I can't railroad them into stuff. I can't, I don't have to have every answer for them, because they're way cleverer at coming up with answers than I am. So, although, I should add in that I did try and railroad my players one other time that just sucked. I mean, there's been other times where I've kind of guided them to, hey, look, for this particular game, the plot's going to require that we start here. So let's make that part happen. And then, okay, now we're started. But there was another one, and it was in a Shadowrun game, and it was terrible. The Shadowrun game, and it was in, the original Harlequin adventure for Shadowrun. And there is a section where they wind up in a compound, and of course the run goes completely sideways, and now they're under heavy fire, And at this point, a van pulls up, the door comes open, and the guy inside, come on, basically, come with me if you want to live, okay?
So Terminator.
You're right. And so the whole plot here hinges on the fact that they have to hop into this van and then ride away. And then, of course, it turns out to be a trap, and they wind up being imprisoned. And as a game master, I didn't realize that it was badly written. I read through the whole thing. I knew what I was doing. I had the whole thing laid out. It never occurred to me how badly written that was. It never occurred to me that they might not want to get into what was obviously a trap. And so when the van pulled up and the door opens and the one guy, Peter says, hell no, I ain't getting in there. I'm like, but you're going to die out here. I'll take my chances. I said, I didn't know what to do. And I forced them into the van, and then they wound up in the trap. And then it was miserable. It was terrible. That whole next session was horrible because Peter was completely shitty to me, as he absolutely had every right to be, because I had forced them into this situation where, oh, now they're in a trap. They have no way out until the big bad guy comes down. They're being tortured, and he knew it was a trap, and he told me he wanted to avoid that trap, and yet I made him do it anyway. And so, that was the worst game mastering I have ever done. It was terrible. Absolutely terrible. But I learned from it, and learned that if they're going to go sideways, I should have just let them do it, and I should have just completely thrown away that whole next part of the adventure. I should have cleverly found some other way to get that information to them, or figure out what that step was going to be, if it was even necessary. But I wasn't good enough then, so
you could just,
I learned.
You could have just said that the guy kidnapped them.
Well, I could have, although these were really powerful Shadowrunners who, it would have been really difficult for someone to come in and kidnap the group of seven of them. But, you know, I could have worked out something. I could have threatened them with a dragon or something, you know, who knows.
But isn't this current day?
Actually, Shadowrun set, oh, you've never played Shadowrun. Shadowrun is set in a future where there is cyber technology.
Yeah.
So, and it's set like, you know, 50 years in the future. And so there's cyber technology. People are all wired up. They interface with computers. There's all this really cool stuff. But, oh, also in this world, magic has come back. And so now there's wizards and there's dragons and there's elves and dwarves and other stuff. So it's kind of like a combination of this sci-fi thing plus a little bit of Dungeons and Dragons.
Huh.
And it's a really interesting world. It's a terrible game system. I don't like the rules. I don't like the way the rules play out. But the world is amazing. I love
Maybe
the whole
Maybe we can make Light Runners the same version of it, except better.
That is a great idea. We really should do something like that, because I think you guys would like playing in that world. The other one, all right, and I skipped over one here, because I moved forward to Shadowrun. But one of my favorite gaming scenes of all time, absolute favorite, and I've probably recounted it to you guys three times already, don't care. The first Paranoia game we had, where I set them, and this was Kyle and Steve again, and I set them on a cruise ship, a Paranoia cruise ship, to take them to their destination, and I told Steve that his secret society mission was to destroy all the clones that were in the clone tanks below deck, because clones were an abomination and needed to be destroyed. And so, it's Paranoia, where your extra clones, these are your backup bodies in case you die. And so destroying your clones, or anyone's clones, it's pretty much murder, because, you know, now if I die, where'd my backup copies go? And so I gave that mission to Steve, fully expecting that he wasn't going to do it, because who's going to go kill their own clones? And the way things worked out, we were passing notes back and forth, and there was a lot of whispering going on, and Steve, he went down there with a hammer and he started smashing clone tanks, and he just started killing these extra bodies downstairs, and Kyle happened to walk in on him at the exact moment that he's doing it. And it was, I still, to this day, the look of shock, surprise, realization on Kyle's face, where, I mean, he looked at me, he looked at Steve holding the big hammer there, he looked at the dead bodies on the ground, and then he comes back to me and he's like, I shoot him. And because I mean, remember, this is Kyle and Steve. They've been gaming together for years. They were in Dungeons & Dragons. They were best friends. They're buddies.
Wait, was this a paranoia where they knew each other?
Well, yeah, they knew they were supposed to be working together. But this was where I actually played live. I know you know only know paranoia from email, where we do everything in secret. But this is where we actually played live at a table, which means you have to pass notes back and forth a lot, and it's really it's a lot of fun. And again, that moment where Kyle just, well, I guess I shoot Steve. And it was, you could tell it just hurt his heart, this realization that he had to shoot Steve, but that's what the game entailed. And Steve was already all into it because Steve was there smashing clones. He already knew what he was doing. And he knew what this was going to bring about. And so sure enough, oh, they started killing each other. And again, another turning point that, oh, you know what? Sometimes player conflict is cool. And we had never had any sort of player conflict before. I mean, at best, it was a disagreement over which passage we go down, or a disagreement on, well, should we just kill the prisoners, or should we bring them along in case it's a good bargaining chip or we need information? I mean, it was never anything serious. But here, it was glorious. Has to be my favorite gaming moment of all time. It really is. But then, okay, let's see. I covered Talos Deep already. That was just that Talos Deep was just that moment of evoking true fear out of my players, which I don't think I had ever seen true fear like that before, and that was really powerful. But then, past that, then it starts getting. Oh well, okay. Two others that involve again with my brother Kyle. We were playing a homebrew game of my own called BFF, and it was four of them playing as best friends, and they were all 13, 14 years old, and they're on this Stephen King Scooby Gang sort of mystery solving thing, but it was intended to be a serious Stephen King sort of horror story, and it was. And it was one that, I mean, they were truly frightened, and they were truly, I mean, it played out just like a Stephen King book. It was great. I mean, there was dimension hopping, and there were mysterious monsters, and it was awesome stuff. But that was one where, when we opened it up, they were four 14-year-olds, 13-year-olds in a tent on a campout in someone's backyard. And they just opened up with just bantering back and forth like kids would do, arguing over which superhero is the strongest, and just stupid stuff. And it was really beautiful because as a game master, we were playing this online. It was actually Kaz, who's going to Gen Con with us, Kaz's wife, my friend Earl, and then my brother Kyle. And I walked away, and like for 20 minutes, I didn't have to do anything because they just role played without me. It was just them being kids and having a great time. And that, I think that may have been my first experience with true character immersion, I guess, where you're watching people who are actually inhabiting these characters and really acting it out and playing the real roles without the, you know, there's in every other game I'd played before that, there was always that, yeah, even when you're playing the role and yeah, that's what my character would do. It's always kind of in a third person control sort of sense. Always that kind of, you know, you still metagame in the background. You're still playing a game. Well, here it wasn't a game. Here it was them really playing the story, really being the people. I love that. So cool. And then, I think the last of my, well, no. Yeah, last of my D&D stories. This was in second edition D&D. We were playing online, and we got into, it was, again, me as game master, as always. And it was Kyle and this time Jeff Hawes, of all people. And it was arguing over the typical argument of what do you do with your prisoners? And in this case, it happened to be gnomes. And it was a family of gnomes, and they were innocent. They had not done anything wrong. They committed the crime of happening to live in the area we're passing through. And so the team had gone in there and roughed them up and caused some damage. And now, crap, if we let them go, they're going to sound an alarm. So we have to kill them. Well, we can't kill them because they haven't done anything wrong. Well, but we have to kill them. What are we going to do? Tie them up? They'll get out of that. They're gnomes. They're slippery. You can't. And it was to the point where Kyle and Jeff were arguing about this in character, to the point where Jeff pulled a weapon and was literally ready to start a lethal battle with my brother over whether or not to kill these gnomes. And I had, okay, again, paranoia showed me the joys of player-to-player combat, player versus player conflict, as it were. This was the first time it actually looked like it was going to come to blows. And they had this tense standoff, and it lasted forever. And as a game master, I panicked. I couldn't, there was no way to make peace. There was no way for me to step in. There was no reason I should have stepped in either. But man, every bone in my body was screaming that I gotta step in and do something. I have to save this. The game's gonna be over if they start killing each other. And I let it go. I let it go because there was nothing I could do. And ultimately, Kyle stood down. They resolved it. It became amicable after that, but it produced a tension in the game. And again, it's inhabiting your character again. It's that real role playing sort of stuff. And it was really intense. One of the most intense moments around. And I wasn't even doing anything. I just sat there and watched it. I was a spectator on this field. And it was crazy. It was the first time I had done that. And that was, that's not even that long ago. All right. So I've been gaming role playing games for 40 years and I know I come across because, I have my own podcast and therefore I am the voice of authority here. And I come across like I know everything, but I don't. Some of these lessons are stuff that I only learned, a decade ago. I mean, after gaming for 25 years, 30 years, I finally start learning what it's like to actually get inside a character. It took me that long. So, everybody at their own pace, I suppose. Now, for me, first time I ever got into a character on my own, I hadn't had a chance to be a player very often. And I had had some experiences, but I never played long enough or got into it. But we had this one, Kaz was our game master, and we were playing in a combination steampunk Dungeons and Dragons sort of world. It was a world he was creating for their contest when Wizards had a big contest to come up with the new world for Dungeons and Dragons, and ultimately Eberron won that one. But Kaz's submission was this steampunk world, which was, we absolutely loved it.
Eberron.
Eberron is just a world that they created for Dungeons and Dragons that I don't know anything about because I've never read any of the books. I've never looked at Eberron. I just happen to know that that's the name of the world. And so they had all sorts of new creatures and new things that went with it.
Name of the guy.
What?
That did it.
I have no idea.
I made it.
Have no idea. We could look it up.
Was this actual people?
Yeah. But in Kaz's steampunk world, we wound up not ever even getting into combat. The game ended after a while, but we were, the characters we had these big developed backstories, and so we get into this setting, and my character was a local girl who was, she was kind of a technomancer engineer, sort of, and put her in there, and then I don't remember any of the other characters except that Dave was playing a half-elven, maybe, but he was some sort of knight or at least he was a warrior with a mission, a holy mission. He was supposed to protect this chosen woman, and he hadn't even met her yet, but he knew that it was his life's mission.
Was it you?
To keep her safe. No, it wasn't me. And so, but this is the point, is his character and my character meet, and again, in the process of actually playing the role and inhabiting the character, we never even got to a scene where we had any combat or any actual gameplay action, but we did all this role-playing to get through this opening of the story, and the two characters clearly just meshed, and they got together well, and there was a moment where he finally meets this woman that he's supposed to be protecting, and even though I know who the woman is, you know, as a player, I knew who she was. I understood what was going on. I understood his duty towards, I understood his duty towards her and all this. And I realized, you know, that that was, you know, strictly his job, and his connection with my character was something other than that entirely. But from my character's point of view, I realized my character was going to be incredibly hurt and fiercely jealous. And I felt so bad for her because, I mean, I know she's got nothing to worry about, but she didn't know that. And somehow in my head could play out both sides of that and hold on to both sides of that and feel her emotion and feel what was eating at her and what was, and it was, I don't know. It was just very, it was just so bizarre to me to be connected enough to a character that I can be inside her emotions, even when I know that what she's experiencing is wrong, that it's a misunderstanding, and I know that, but that didn't stop her from feeling it, and it was really cool. All right, I enjoyed the crap out of that. And I suppose I've been rambling on way too long. I'm probably boring you guys with these old war stories. Is that agreeing with me?
Yes.
Are you Chewbacca now?
Yes.
Yeah, he's speaking Wookiee, but I can translate. And yes, I understand that Wookiee is probably not the name of Chewbacca's language, but that's what I'm going to call it. Yeah, I'm going to call it Wookiee. I'm sure there's a name for that language, but we're not going to
Wonky.
Last story was just, and this is, I can't believe that it took me until, okay, we've been playing our current Pathfinder game that we play every other Thursday. We've been playing this for 4 years now. And so this was about 3.5-4 years ago that I had this experience. And I can't believe it took me that long to get to it. But when my character Dothan first leveled up, like literally went from level 1 to level 2, it was the first time a character that I myself was playing leveled up. And up until that moment, I mean, I knew leveling up was a big deal. I knew players enjoyed that. I knew it was a big part of the process. It was, but up until that moment, before it happened to me, I thought leveling up was, yeah, it's cool, it's awesome, but it's not necessarily necessary to a game. Like I designed lots of role-playing games where, you know what, advancement, experience, leveling up, whatever, we'll leave that to the fates. We don't really need that because, you know what, that's not the important part. The important part is that we're telling a good story, right? That's all that matters. And then it happened to me. And it doesn't have to be leveling up necessarily. It can just be advancement of whatever type. But in Pathfinder, Dungeons & Dragons, it's leveling up. And so for me, that moment of leveling up, the joy, oh my God. I mean, and now, you know, we're now 11th level now. So, you know, I've gotten to do this 9 more times since then. I love leveling up. It is so, I don't know. It's cathartic. You've been waiting for it forever. Now the moment's here. All right, sweet. We get to update all the numbers. We get new powers. We get new abilities. There's something so cool about that. And especially in the game we've been playing for 4 years, when you feel like you've earned it. So never again will I decide offhand that advancement is not really all that important for a role-playing game, because you know what? It really is. I understand that it's the story, it's the characters, and all that experience is awesome. It's wonderful, but, players sometimes need that. They need that tangible numbers on paper or, you know, physical representation that shows the advancement that you've made. And it's so much fun. So, all right. Anyway, enough of my war stories. We've done enough of the gaming table. It's now already way past Noah's bedtime, and we still have to get to the science fiction double feature. Science fiction double feature. That's right. I can't.
That's right. Here on Nerd Pride Radio, you get not one, but two movie reviews for the same low, low, low price.
Very nice. All right, and you can sit back a little bit. I know you're...
Sorry.
Oh, no. Don't... Never apologize. That's better. He knows his part's coming up. He got really excited, so he was getting up on the mic. And so it was a little bit loud there, but totally worth it because now you guys are aware of his excitement. Now you can just sit back like you were. You're doing great. All right.
All right. So the two things we are reviewing today. Spider-Man Homecoming. My dad will help me with that one. But I will review War for the Planet of the Apes all on my own.
Okay. You can do it all on your own, buddy. Spider-Man Homecoming?
You can add in stuff. All right. Sorry.
What did you think of Spider-Man Homecoming? And, oh, remember, in both of these reviews, do your very best not to spoil anything. All right? We don't do spoilers.
What? That's impossible! Spider-Man is awesome.
All right. Guys, we're going to try and make this spoiler-free.
But we can't.
No.
I'm going to put in as many spoilers as possible.
We're going to try and do this spoiler-free.
You always spoil a movie.
Not always. We're going to try and be spoiler-free, but this is Noah's segment, and
I'm going to do whatever I want.
He feels some spoilers may be required, and therefore...
All spoilers must be required.
Therefore, you might want to skip ahead 15 minutes. So, all right, although, before we get to the potentially spoiler-laden portion where Noah's guiding the ship, I will just let you know that Spider-Man Homecoming, really good movie. You should go watch it. War for the Planet of the Apes, even better movie. And you definitely should see the whole trilogy with Rise, Dawn, and War because... Holy cow, these are good movies. If you haven't seen the first two, I don't even know why. What's wrong with... Although, you know what? Did I tell you Yancey hasn't seen the first two movies?
I haven't seen the first two movies.
Oh my god. You know what?
I went in there blind. I thought the humans were good. Spoilers.
Oh. Okay. Anyway, both of these were really good movies, and I recommend them. But I'm going to turn it over to Noah now. Sorry about that.
So, Spider-Man Homecoming is... sort of a little branch off from Age of Ultron, because it has some things relating to Age of Ultron, such as him joining into the fight with Ant-Man, Captain America,
they actually show part of his scene from Civil War in this movie. So this is the first Spider-Man where Spider-Man is actually part of the whole Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yeah. So... basically, Spider-Man and Tony Stark are friends.
Yes.
Friends.
Okay, his quote marks. Okay, now we're not here to recount the entire movie. We just want to tell what we liked about it.
And some of my favorite stuff is the fighting scene. And Karen. Karen is the best. Like a boat was cut in half and at the end of it, when he webbed
it... But no spoilers.
But when he webbed it all together, she's like, good job, Spider-Man. You only did it 99% correctly. He's like, what?
Okay.
And it all breaks apart.
So, no
spoilers. Iron Man saves.
No spoilers. Yeah, really. Look, if you haven't figured out that he's going to spoil these movies, seriously skip ahead. Okay.
If you skip ahead in front of this, but not in front of... War of the Planet of the Apes, I'm sorry.
Let me tell you what. I think Vulture.
Oh, yeah.
Vulture. I mean, look, you know you love Michael Keaton. Michael Keaton is great. Michael Keaton was Batman. Michael Keaton was Birdman. Michael Keaton is Vulture. And Michael Keaton...
imagine...
tears it up. And
imagine a war-toned... Vulture, where instead of just having the wings, imagine them being iron and sharp.
Oh, here's the thing. Vulture is, and again, we just saw it last week, so maybe it's just, you know, because it's so recent that it's ranking so high in my head, but Vulture is really one of my favorite villains of any superhero movie. Not for his abilities. Not for his powers. I mean, look, the suit's cool and he does some awesome stuff and he's really cool. But because of his origin story.
May I speak?
Is this your segment?
Yes.
All right, you can speak. Spoilers.
One downside. You never see Eggman But wait until the end, and boom, there's Vulture with Eggman.
Huh.
Now, one of the most surprising... Nope.
No, don't give away the most surprising thing. Don't do that. Really don't do that. I mean, you can give some spoilers, but don't give that part away. That would be... No, don't do it. And we're back. I had to pause it to make sure he really doesn't give away that big spoiler. Okay. I mean, I didn't read anything about this movie before we went. I wasn't even really all that much looking forward to it. And it caught me off guard, and it was really cool. There are some downsides to this movie. The man in the chair bothers me. It seems
like... Why would he even need a man in the chair? And why make it fat?
Well, look. Here's the thing. Every superhero lately seems to need a man in a chair. Right? He's a man in the chair. It is the person who works behind the scenes, doesn't have any superpowers of their own, but tends to be a computer expert, the world's greatest hacker, and feeds information to your superhero through their headpiece while they're out doing heroic stuff.
Like Flash has...
Right. Flash has his team behind the scenes that are feeding him information. That's his man in the chair.
Batman. Alfred.
Yes. Birds of Prey has Oracle sitting behind the scenes. Apparently Green Arrow has a man in the chair.
I think it's that
girl. Who might
be
a woman. Yeah, who might be a woman. I don't know. But Green Arrow's got a man in the chair. And now
Spider-Man has a man in the chair.
And this is... go listen to Angry Geeks Versus, because they talk about Spider-Man Homecoming as well. And they... Yeah, the purpose of the man in the chair is... Whereas Spider-Man is a loner, which means... There's an awful lot of the Spider-Man comics that is done in thought bubbles because we're just inside Spider-Man's head the whole time. Well, you know, you can't do that as well in a movie. Therefore, you have the man in the chair. Therefore, he has someone to actually speak to, and it gives us all this exposition and background stuff that we wouldn't have gotten otherwise.
You could have just man in the chair with Karen.
Well, you know, you could have, but you didn't. So, there's that. Which I don't think Spider-Man needs a manager. I mean, I like the character. You know, I think it's a cool kid, but it also, again, every man in the chair seems to have to be the world's greatest hacker. They can break into anything. They get through any security system, and they do it in seconds, and they give you all the information you need right when you need it. And so Spider-Man's guy can do the same stuff, except he's a high school kid. I mean, you know, I get that for plot purposes they needed this, but There had to be a better way to do it. There really did. The other thing, though, is if you go listen to Angry Geeks Versus, they complain that they liked the movie as well. They liked the movie a lot, but their big complaint was certain things about the movie that were drastically changed from the comic books, and they didn't like that. They felt like it wasn't being true to the comics, to which, I mean, all respect to the Angry Geeks, because I love those guys, but whatever. I mean, honestly, for me, I don't care that they change it up because...
May I put in a bit of my little segmenting?
Your 5 cents? Go ahead.
Whenever I'm going to do some science fiction double feature segment, I'll have this little mini segment. Best character.
Okay, go for it.
I'd say the begin quote, man in the chair, end quote.
Really? You liked him?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was pretty cool.
Yeah.
I mean, look, if you're going to have a man in the chair, this guy was awesome because remember the joy that you saw in Peter Parker when you saw Civil War? You remember how awesome it was that, like, he's there and he's Spider-Man and yet he's also this slobbering fanboy because he loves all these heroes and he's so excited that he gets to be near them. And you get to see a lot of that from him in this movie as well. But his buddy, his man in the chair, whose name completely escapes me, was even more so. I mean, he's just a fan. He loves this. He is so excited, so full of joy just to be any part of this process at all. And it was really infectious and it was really cool.
Also,
so if they were going to have a guy, I mean, that was pretty cool.
Also, best scene is another bit. And it's...
No spoilers.
It's And mine, I am not telling you what it is, but I'll tell you. If you want to see the best scene ever, wait. And wait.
Oh, God. Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
wait
for the
end.
Oh, God. The closing credit scene is maybe my favorite closing credit scene.
You can't tell them about it.
Ever. Oh, no, he is
so good.
He is dead on. That was awesome. So anyway, the whole point is Spider-Man Homecoming. You know, it's still a Spider-Man movie. Aunt May is young and hot. Well, younger than she usually is and hot. It's Marissa Tomei, for goodness sake. We didn't have to watch Uncle Ben die. We didn't have to go through an origin story. We got straight into a bunch of fun action, and it was, even though they changed a lot of stuff.
How'd you get your powers? I was bitten by a spider. End of backstory.
That was it.
That, it literally was. The man in the chair, as I'm gonna call him, was like, how'd you get your superpowers? And Peter Parker was like, I was bitten by a spider.
That was it. I was gonna say, look, young Aunt May, they changed MJ, the suit. There was some things that were different. And again, while my friends over at Angry Geeks complained about that, some of that. Yeah, for me, you know what? It's a different world. And it's a different, you know, Marissa Tomei as Aunt May. Look, Peter Parker is 15 in this movie. He's 15 years old. How old is Aunt May supposed to be? How does he get a 70-year-old aunt when he's 15? I mean, is this great Aunt May, you know? So having Aunt May be 50-something Marissa Tomei is way more appropriate to Peter's age, and she's a fine character. I have no problem. Even though, yeah, it's not our traditional Aunt May. The suit was different. Oh, hey, Aiden's home. He'll be home just in time for some Pot-O-Matic.
Hey, how's it going?
We are currently about to go into my review of War of the Planet of the Apes.
But even though all that stuff is different, I don't mind it being different because, you know, movies have to be different. And if this is the story they want to tell, I'm excited to go along for the ride. We retell stories all the time. But this was a great Peter Parker. This was a high school 15-year-old Peter Parker. And he very much had the funny lines and the teen angst and the stuff that was Spider-Man when Spider-Man was starting out. That was what made him a popular
hero.
May I
also have a little mini segment that's not going to be in most of these, but
just you can do whatever you can do whatever you want, man.
This is my mini segment, most obvious from the title. For this one, it is there's a homecoming dance.
Oh yeah, they did actually go to homecoming. Although the secondary meaning of that title,
yeah.
All the other Spider-Man movies haven't been part of the Marvel movies. They've always been, it's Sony doing their own separate thing, not part of the Marvel world. Well, this is the first Spider-Man movie where he's come home to the Marvel universe. It's kind of like a homecoming. His mind's blown. You can't see the mind blown symbol.
But still, that's not the most obvious.
That's not?
No. You know, homecoming for most people is homecoming dance.
Yes, they did have that. Yes, and he did go to the dance very briefly. All right, let's put Spider-Man behind us
and let's go on.
Let's talk about how much
how
much you cried at War for the Planet of the Apes.
Hold on. Here's the cryometer for a pretty tough guy. 80% of the movie was me either crying out of such a sad scene or because it was so awesome.
Yeah.
And then the other 20% was my mouth just opening wide.
All right. He cried at this movie like his brother Jacob cried when Diego died in Ice Age, which I know you weren't there, but I'm telling you, when we watched
Diego?
The saber-toothed tiger. When we thought Diego was dead in Ice Age, like, all of a sudden, they have this big scene, and you think Diego's dead, and we're just watching, and all of a sudden, Jacob, who couldn't have been, I mean, how old was he then? 9?
He had to be like Noah's age.
Yeah, he was 9 or 10. All of a sudden, just bawling, just audibly sobbing. And, I mean, it was first one of our kids had cried at a movie like that. And it was, I mean, yes, we make fun of him for it now, but, you know, it was very powerful for him. It was, he'd never been part of such a sad scene before. So Noah, his movie is going to be War for the Planet of the Apes because Noah was very moved by this film.
Too good. Too good.
Okay. So,
now, this...
No spoilers.
...is the most obvious thing from the title. There's a war.
Is Boom. It for the Planet of the Apes?
Yes.
Yeah, it's not the Planet of the Apes yet, but it's yes, it becomes war. The Planet of the Apes. So,
well, spoilers!
Oh, I'm sorry. You missed the part where every time I say no spoilers, I'm being really sarcastic because...
There are many.
Noah is incapable of not spoiling the movie. So they've gotten their warning, and if they're still listening now, it's completely at their own risk. War for the Planet of the Apes was great, y'all. I mean, this
y'all?
Was...
Y'all? Okay, hold on.
Okay.
That now, was me imitating my brother.
Now, quickly, next bit. Best character. Bad Ape. We'll get to him later.
We'll get to Bad Ape later. Let's get to Bad Ape now. Bad Ape was awesome.
Bad Ape is so good. You just find him in the snow. He's like, Bad Ape. Bad Ape. No, Touchy.
Yeah,
no Touchy.
Yeah, he wasn't part of their original group, but they find Bad Ape, and Bad Ape is awesome. And I'm listening to Bad Ape, and I'm like, I know that guy. I know. And somewhere along the line, there was some line that I'm like, oh my God, that's Steve Zahn. That's got to be Steve. Sure enough, we look it up when we get home. It was Steve Zahn. I love Steve Zahn. That guy
what else
is
he been
in? He was in Saving Silverman. He was in. He's not. I'm going to list off movies. He was in Happy Texas. Does that help you?
Yes.
You've never seen Happy Texas.
Okay. I've seen parts of Happy Texas.
Okay, may I speak?
But I love Steve Zahn.
The first scene that I shall tell you of when you first see Bad Ape is Gun. And grenade pack fly out of the shadows.
It doesn't help them.
And then what comes out looks like Gollum from Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, Bad Ape was not a healthy looking ape. But look, War for the Planet of the Apes, the whole Planet of the Apes series, the CGI is just masterful.
Oh my God.
Yeah, Andy...
I forgot it was CGI in the middle of the movie.
That's the whole point. Yeah, and I did that with the previous ones too. You get, you know, at first you're like, wow, that is great CGI. And then you get, you know, 20 minutes into the movie and you completely forget that this is CGI. You forget that it's all animated because these are real apes. These are real people and it was wonderful. All right. Steve Zahn as Bad Ape was amazing. Andy Serkis is without peer when it comes to this motion capture stuff. He's really good.
May I now speak in my segment?
You do whatever you want, dude.
My favorite scene includes my favorite character. So they are in this torture camp.
No spoilers.
And so the monkeys have figured out how many steps from these tunnels it takes to get to both places. And so, to start it off, this one monkey is in the tunnel and the hole's already...
They're not monkeys, they're apes, but go ahead.
Apes. This ape has already dug the hole pretty much, and so he keeps on pointing to his back, and after a while, Bad Ape realizes what he's trying to tell him to do, and he's like, no, and then the other ape, roar! Sorry for
That's
popping
okay.
it off.
That's okay. Yeah, it's all, look, that was a very physical scene, but
the
physical comedy of an animated ape, voiced by Steve Zahn, the physical comedy of this animated ape, was just, again, masterful.
And then he digs up, his head pokes out, there's a foot next to him, he goes back in, and then he comes back out once the guy leaves and goes, Bad Ape. Bad Ape.
It was
beautiful.
So good. Oh, and Woody Harrelson is our bad guy. And look, you guys know I love Woody Harrelson in anything. And this one's no exception. The guy is great. How can you not like Woody Harrelson in something? So,
also, what I imagine with that scene when his head pokes out, it's like Whack-an-Ape.
Yeah. Yes, I agree. I'm trying to think of what else to tell you about it other than, look, if you saw the first two, then you know you're going to like this one, so go see it. And I would recommend seeing it in the theater because it's an experience and it's great.
Also, never, ever, ever, ever.
Get to the point!
Ever think the humans are the good guys.
No, 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 no. Look, here's the thing. In the earlier movies,
yeah,
there's conflict back and forth, and there is, at the back of your mind, there's always this hope that they're going to find a way to get along because, look, we all want the same thing. We're all good people. Monkeys and apes should learn, or monkeys and apes, apes and humans should learn to live together and share this planet. And we try, and you think, God, it's going to work. It's going to work. It's got to. And yet, you also know from the earlier movies, you know that Planet of the Apes, ultimately, apes rule everything and humans are you know, dumb animals. So you know that it's not going to end well for humans. And yet, you always want it to. Oh, wouldn't it be nice?
Just for this one, I'm going to have a second favorite for the scenes and character thing.
My second favorite? Seriously?
Yes, because this is important.
All right, is this one going to make sense to them?
Second favorite hit character is Nova, the silent girl. She's so character helping because she's sign languages and has the ape flu.
All right, hold on. Can I interject?
Yes.
You can always interject.
Okay, real quick. No spoilers. So the ape flu that caused the apes to become smart is now causing the humans to become dumber.
No spoilers.
Becoming like apes.
And so she is now acting like an ape. And it's really fascinating to watch them teach her sign language like she is how we teach sign language to chimps now.
Yeah, exactly. They blended it in pretty well to finally give us a relatively logical reason why the Planet of the Apes would look the way it does, you know, in the original movie or even in the Marky Mark version, where you wind up showing up on a planet full of apes and there are humans around, but humans seem to be mostly dumb animals. And the whole ape flu, as it's worked through its full progression here, oh, okay, that explains why we've gotten to this point. Okay, we get it. So, it all ties together well. They're just good movies. Just good movies. So, look, okay, let's end the spoilers now, because I think we're done with the movie review portion of this. Okay. Did you have more that you wanted to add?
My second favorite scene.
Okay, second favorite scene. Go for it.
Is Avalanche. That's it.
Really?
That's all I'm saying.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
It was pretty intense.
Now you don't want to give spoilers.
Well, no. There's a difference between spoilers and then super spoilers. Because there's some stuff that, yeah, he's obviously spoiling parts of the movie. But there are certain things like the big reveal in Spider-Man. We didn't give that one away. Stuff like that. So there's certain things that we're not going to, that you don't have to go into. So, all right. God, I had more to say, I think, but yeah, doesn't matter. We're all done. You know what? You know what that means? It's time for
the pub.
Automatic.
Oh, it's
hot
not on.
Dog. This is the Nerd Pride Radio Podomatic. At the end of every cast, I bring out R2 and his fully pimped out Podomatic bubble, and he rolls up random topics for me. Me, a.k.a. my dad, to talk about. And where do these topics come from, you ask? Well, that is where you come in. You want to hear me haver on about something? Send your question or topic to me by email, or better yet, in a private message on our forums, and he'll add it to the Podomatic list. Podomatic is about whatever you want it to be.
Awesome. And our first number is 12. Good job, Noah.
And a good caster would already have the Podomatic list up.
Well, you know what? I'm getting there. So, first up, here it is. Number 12. Oh, great. All right, here.
That's not.
Yep. Here's the deal. You know how, like a month ago, maybe a little bit more, I complained because my brother is way too generous in his Podomatic entries, and he was dominating the whole list, and My brother and I both challenged you guys to maybe submit some Podomatics of your own and, you know, crowd him out of this list a little bit. Well, guess what? This week, someone finally answered my call.
Called Produce Farmer.
All the bonus points. All of them go to Produce Farmer. Thank you, dude. I appreciate getting these. And as it turns out, our number one, number 12, actually, but our first one is from Produce Farmer. And Produce Farmer says, do older gamers become fossilized in their ability to embrace new games and systems, especially crunchy ones? Sort of. I mean, I think
it's like, I can't say anything because
it's like, yeah, you don't know, you don't know what it's like to be an old gamer. Like the way that people become, really set in their musical tastes and I don't know if it's just way too much effort to move forward or to learn something new, but you wind up listening to the music of your youth on the oldies station.
Pick me.
But why? What do you got?
Okay, so I don't know anything about role-playing or board games, for I've not been doing that long. But from a video game standpoint, you don't really get set in your ways as you look forward to seeing advancements in what we can do with it. And I guess that applies somewhat to role-playing and board games with Starfinder coming out, is we have a concept that with a little work we could do so much more with.
Yes, but here's the thing, and what he's specifically asking about, that I can see some of that is there are a lot of people out there who have, like, I've never moved on to 4th edition or 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons. I just stick with my Pathfinder. Look, I already know Pathfinder. I've invested years in Pathfinder. I'll just stick with that. Whereas the new systems may be a lot more fun, for all I know. People refer to Pathfinder as the crunchiest of the Dungeons & Dragons versions. It has the most complex rule set. And that, new people getting in the hobby seem to really like 5th edition because it's not as complicated. But, you know, for me, it's not, okay, yeah, I haven't moved on from Pathfinder because I haven't found a good reason to yet. I don't want to invest in learning a whole new Dungeons & Dragons that's essentially the same sort of game I've been playing for 40 years, but now with a new set of rules. So I can see what you're talking about. But on the other hand, to answer your question, I think yes, there is resistance to learning new stuff after a while. That you look back and you see, God, you know, I've invested so much in all of these. God, learning a new game, boy, that seems really tough. But it ties back to my policy of never saying no. If someone wants to introduce me to a new game, I will always try it. Because look, I put off learning collectible card games. Put off learning Magic the Gathering specifically because it seemed like such an investment. It seemed like, and I had this, you know, moral objection to the idea of collectible games. And I put it off. And now that I've played it, I realize, wow, it's really cool. And it offers me a lot of opportunities because there's lots of people who play Magic and now I can be a part of that. It's a social opportunity. It's a fun game. And things like, when I sat down to play Dark Souls, the board game at game night, a couple months back, that, yeah, you know what? It's a big, complicated board game and the rules are really complex. And there's so many little fiddly bits coming out of that box that when they asked me and they said, hey, you want to sit on some Dark Souls with us? And in my heart of hearts, there was nothing that I would like to do less then play a game of Dark Souls right that moment. It did not look appealing to me. There was no way I wanted to sit down and look at that. The rules intimidated the crap out of me. And yet, you know what? My policy is I always say yes. So I sat down. I learned the game, and it turned out, yeah, it was exactly as complex as I thought it was, but it wasn't that tough to catch on. I got it. And we had a great time. I think that fossilization you're talking about, it's a fear of learning something new. It's an intimidation at all that effort that's going to have to go into it. And yet, I mean, for me personally, again, battling the Alzheimer's here, staving off dementia as long as possible by learning new stuff as much as I can. I love exploring new games, and so I will always say yes, and I will always keep trying to not be that guy who's too set in his ways to try something new. Because, I you know what? If I could have, instead of playing Dark Souls, you know, I could have played another couple rounds of Guillotine, or I could have played, you know, Catan, or some other game I'd played dozens of times before. But I got a new experience with new people, and it was great. It was great, and I learned, do I ever want to play Dark Souls again? Nope. I don't have any urge. I've played it. I understand it. I had a good time doing it. But now I've got that basis to compare it to and go, yeah, you know what? I'll play one of these other ones. We'll be fine. But I tried it. And I think that's important. But yes, I do think, let me just make sure I'm answering your question. Do older gamers become fossilized in their ability to embrace new games, especially crunchy ones? Yeah, I think they do, simply because out of fear of trying something new, or you know, they've tried a bunch of new things in their lives, and now they're to the point where they just don't see trying something new as something that's going to pay off for them, you know? Yeah, I'll play it. It'll be a fun game, whatever, but is it going to be as much fun as this other thing that I already know so well? Yeah, you know what? Let's just stick with what we know. I know this was, it's like going to a restaurant, and I always want to try something new on the menu, but you know, if I'm going to spend this much money on a meal and I don't go out to eat that often, you know, do I really want to try something new when I may wind up spending, you know, $20 for something I hate? Or should I go for that old favorite that I know I'm going to have a great meal no matter what, you know? And so people shy away from the new, which is a shame. They shouldn't. They absolutely shouldn't. So, enough rambling. That is
69,
dude. All
I don't right. get it.
It's from the movie Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
What movie?
Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. When they're told to pick a number, think of a number, and they go 69. And so it was 69, dude. That was how they said it. All right. This one is from Zimny. And Zim says, which is the best type of tiefling? The one descended from demons or the one descended from devils?
What's tiefling?
Tieflings are, they're half demon or half, or, well, not half, but as in Pathfinder or in Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah.
Tieflings are characters who have the blood of evil creatures from the outer planes. So demons, devils, stuff like that. You have some sort of bloodline that gives you special abilities. Okay. Having said that, you know what? Tieflings are tieflings. It doesn't really matter that much. But if you're going to give me a choice, I think devils are way more interesting than demons. Especially if you're going to stick with the alignment stuff, like if you're going to be a tiefling who is not going to be evil, then I think, you know, still sticking with either the lawful nature of the devils or the chaotic nature of the demons, I think incorporating that into your personality, even though you're not evil, you still maintain that law or chaos side of it. I think the law side of it is more interesting as a role-playing adventure. The idea of being a lawful neutral. I haven't played a lawful neutral character myself, but they are... Well, no, I did. I did, in fact, once. But anyway, lawful neutral is one of my favorite alignments just because I find it interesting. I think that there is a lot of role-playing opportunity in being lawful neutral. The idea that order matters, that following the rules matters, that, you know what, there's a process for this, damn it, that matters. And I think that's really cool. And so, yeah, a tiefling who has this need for order and structure, I think would be really cool. That would be my preference. So therefore, I guess devil, now that you've said it. 39. All right. 39 is... it's from my wife. That does not bode well for me.
Why?
Because she always asks me really difficult questions that usually involve me singing or talking in a weird voice, and I can't handle it.
I'm sorry. What?
So, she's just not been nice to me on Potomac. Oh, wait, this one's not bad, though. My wife asks, we just finished binge watching Once Upon a Time. Which character was your favorite? Which character was most like you? Ooh. Ooh, all right. For those of you who haven't been watching Once Upon a Time, it's great mindless TV. It is awesome. It's interesting characters, interesting stories. Quite often they solve problems using magical tricks that we just learned about 20 minutes ago so that now it can come back and save the day for us. And so sometimes, you know, it's a little too convenient and that kind of thing, but it's fun. It's just always fun. And my favorite character in Once Upon a Time is, I know. My favorite character in Once Upon a Time is the Evil Queen, but only the Evil Queen when she's in the modern world. I don't like her all dressed up as the original Evil Queen from Fairy World. I like her in the modern world, and I think she's really cool, and I enjoy her. But the character that I most like, the character most like me, man, do you have an answer for me? No, see, she doesn't have an answer. She's posing a challenging question that, off the top of my head, Jiminy Cricket. Yeah, no. That pansy. Yeah, no. I don't know. Part of me wants to say Emma. Just because, she's always looking out for other people. It's sometimes reluctantly, but maybe always looking out for others. Maybe Robin, you think I could be as sexy as Robin Hood? Really? Oh, man.
Well, you're although, sexier than Robin Hood.
But thank you. Yeah, Robin Hood's pretty good. Because again, his commitment and devotion to his family is pretty commendable.
And his That's a great forgiveness one. Of people who have...
Yes, his ability to forgive. That's a good one. I like Robin Hood. I wasn't thinking of him because he's never, this show, one of its main qualities is very, female driven. The primary characters in most episodes are the women. And so Robin Hood, now that she brings it up, Robin Hood's a great character. And yeah, I have no problem with being like Robin Hood, but he is kind of a secondary character, so I didn't think of him. Immediately like that. So that's pretty good. I can take that. So 80. And I think we are about wrapped up here. So let me go to 80 and this will be our last one. 80's from my brother Kyle. It says, earbuds. The solid ones you just set in your ears or the ones that have silicone cups that seal your ears? I like the silicone cup ones. I like the little ones with the little soft, the little soft head on them, just more comfortable that way. So, but you know, I'm not really picky about it. I'll take whatever I can get. But yeah, I prefer the ones with the silicone cup on them. So there you go. All right, that's it for the Podomatic. I'm going to turn it over to GLaDOS, and she will give us a recap of this week's episode so far.
Remember when the platform was sliding into the fire pit and I said goodbye, and you were like,
"No way!"
And then I was all, "We pretended we were going to murder you."
That was great.
This podcast is copyright 2017 by Nerd Pride Radio. The opening and closing theme is Death Metal Disco by Ian Kronk. My bumper music this week was Weezer's In the Garage and, Science Fiction Double Feature by Me First and the Gimme Gimmies. All the songs I use are available on iTunes. You check them out, buy them, enjoy them. Wouldn't put them on my podcast if I didn't love them. Don't forget, this podcast is, for the time being, a proud member of the Nerd Pride Network.
Why for the time being?
Well, because my brother's podcast, The Cast and the Curious, is no longer functioning. And
why?
Because his kids didn't want to do it anymore because they suck. And then Angry Geeks Versus is finishing after this season. They've decided that they've come to the end of their run. And then Me Like Trivia hasn't had new episodes in about 6 months. So, therefore, I may be the lone member of the Nerd Pride Network pretty soon. But that's okay. Anyway, Nerd Pride Network, quality nerd podcasting from quality nerd people. If you want to help out Nerd Pride, subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or whatever podcatcher you use, and write us a nice review because those make a difference. Give us 5 stars. Make us feel good about ourselves. But The nicest thing you can do for this podcast is recommend it to your friends, because you're enjoying it, so you need to spread the word. Tell one other person this week. Let other people enjoy it. Word of mouth is my bread and butter, people. Remember, I'm always looking for you listeners to do my work for me, so don't forget to send me questions and topics for the Podomatic, just like Produce Farmer, this week's winner. Watch out every week on the forums on Facebook for listener betrayal. And if you have a really interesting nerd fact about an upcoming episode number, oh, please send it to me and save me all that grueling research. My contact information, Mike at Nerd Pride Radio, at Nerd Pride Radio on Twitter, facebook.com/nerdprideradio. But to be completely honest, the very best way to talk to me is to come sign up for my forums at nerdprideradio.com/nerds. Sign up, send me a message, we will hang out together. We will become best friends in the world, as I'm working on doing with Produce Farmer right now. We'll have fun. And now it's time for Listener Betrayal. At the beginning of every cast, I go out on my forums and on Facebook, and I post up, hey guys, I am recording. Anything you want to say will get read off right here at the end of the cast, which is what I'm doing right this moment. So, straight over to my forums. The first one up is, oh man, we have got a lot of people tonight. This is good. Oh, you guys are so awesome. First is Eliahad. Eliahad says, hi Mike, I get to see you soon. Rock on. Yeah, what's today's date? The 5th? So, oh man, 10 more days? Is that right? Yeah. 11. Whatever. A week from Wednesday. All right. So, Eliahad continues, we all have memorable lines from movies and TV shows that we quote at the drop of a hat, right? So, hello, my name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die. That's a good one. But that can't be your favorite, can it? What's your favorite memorable line ever? What about your most often spoken one? Oh, man. I would say Inigo Montoya is my favorite because, I mean, it's always been at the top of the list, always been up there. And also because I can't think of any others off the top of my head because the pressure is on. I would need, a group having a conversation and we could all throw quotes out there and then I would correct myself and go, oh, wait, no, you're right, that's way better. But I can't do that on the spot like this.
Wait, Dad. I know the best quote.
What?
I just said it. It's from War of the Planet of the Apes. From Nova. Not speaking whatsoever.
That's cheating. What about the one I say most often? Again.
This.
My kids.
From War of the Planet of the Apes.
My kids would correct me on this, and, you know, if we had a conversation, I'm sure I would come up with ones I say more often than this, but one I know I say a lot is, I quote Darth Vader when I say, I am your father. I do that one a lot because, you know, I have a lot of kids and there's always good reasons to use that line. But I don't know off the top of my head. You know what? As I think about this during the week, I'm sure next week I will either do an update or a Mike was wrong and I will correct this. But those are the answers I have off the top of my head. Eliahad says, my most used memorable line is from MST3K the movie, and the quote is, well, there you have it, a letter opener. I've never seen MST3K the movie, so I don't know that one, but I will trust you that that's really funny. And then he says, okay, so great. Probably not my most used one, though. It's up there. I'm rambling now. It's the excitement. Smell you later. Hey, dude, 10, 11 days, whatever it is. Yeah, we'll be there very soon. All right. Next up, hey, it's Produce Farmer. Look at the commitment on this guy. You already won, dude. This is just gravy. I appreciate it. Produce Farmer says, hi, Mike. Hi, Produce Farmer. I'm gonna betray you now. In the vein of entertainment from the 80s, are there any old board games you remember loving as a kid that didn't quite live up to the hype when revisited later in life? Monopoly is my go-to answer for this, by the way. Oh, yeah. Look. I played way too much Monopoly as a kid, and only later did I finally realize that Monopoly sucks. And then I realized that, hey, you know what? I've always thought Monopoly sucked. I mean, as much as I played it, as much as we had a good time with it, there was always that, yeah, it's fun, and okay, now it's the tedious part. All right, let's get through this until it's over. And that grinding until the obvious winner finally actually wins. That's just, it bugged me. Risk, same way. I love Risk, all right? And the problem with it was eventually it got to the point where the winner is obvious, and then you do that grinding for it, and it just, oh, it's tedious. And you had, within the tedium, the one thing that Risk had going for it was this saving grace of, okay, but if I take a country, okay, I now have enough cards for a set. You turn in your set, and you get like this massive now 50 armies, because you've been playing long enough that you're getting a crap ton of armies for your trade-in. And so you get this crap ton of armies, and you're like, this is my moment, and you make this huge push that, you know, it's like, this is what's going to turn around for me. This is where I finally get to set up and really get to do something for real. And you know in your heart of hearts it's not true, but you get that push where for a moment you expand out from Australia and you suddenly conquer all of Asia. You're pushing into Africa, maybe even crossing into Alaska. You're feeling good about yourself. And then, of course, the very next turn, that guy just stomps you back into the dirt, and you're lucky if you can even keep Australia after that. It's, you know, so it had it, Risk, at least in the tedium portion, had those brief moments of, woohoo, I have 100 armies to throw on a suicide mission. But it was never enough. Never. So, yeah, those are the ones that I most dislike now, based on how much I really liked him as a kid. Oh, okay. Then he goes on and says, hope you're having an excellent weekend. Say hi to your co-hosts for me. Hi, Noah.
Hi.
That's from Produce Farmer. He appreciates you.
Hello, Produce Farmer.
Next up is Kaz. And Kaz says, early betrayal, excellent. Who is your MVP in the current Paranoia game? Inquiring minds want to know. It would be, there's so many possible answers to this.
But you can't say the real person.
I can't. The best of the characters so far. I can't tell you. Because I can't tell you what's going on behind the scenes. I can't tell you what's in people's heads. I can't tell you all the cool stuff. I wish I could, but there are secrets. There are secrets. But I will tell you that I love Phoenix's obsession with his hair. That tickles me. And I really like Vlad the Spider-Bot, because I thought that having a Spider-Bot run along for the ride, especially a smart-ass one like this, I thought it would be a little off-putting for anyone who was in the previous game, where Spider-Bots were like the creepy crawlies that came out of the woodwork. I mean, they were the horror show of the last game of Paranoia. They were the bad guys, and I thought for sure that having a Spider-Bot on the team would be really disturbing to people, and yet nobody seems to mind having him around. And, you know, he's not being all creepy crawly at this point. But I like Vlad a lot. Vlad is actually a reused character type. It's same name, even. Vlad stands for Vent, Light, and Duct Bot. And Vlad was originally a character played by my brother back in an early Paranoia game. And Vlad was awesome. I can't even tell you what Vlad did back in the day, because, it's dirty. But he was a great character. And so I reused some elements of my brother's character to create a new Vent, Light, and Duct Bot. And I really like having him around. But I can't tell you who's the shining star yet, because I can't reveal anything. I can't even tell you who would be the shining star, because then that would give you guys reasons to go look and see what might be out there. So I can't do that. But I would like to, but I can't. So good question though. Let's see. And then that's it. That's it for listener betrayal on my forums. But let's go out to Facebook. You know, what the heck, and see what we got. And on Facebook, it says, oh, okay, Nellie's first. Nellie says, hi, I'm glad I snuck in on this one. What are your favorite colors in Magic? And she spells colors with a U, because she's classy and European like that.
Wait, she's European?
Yes, German, born in Germany, raised in Ireland. And she said, what are your favorite colors in magic? Also, mechanics and theme. All right. I don't know enough to know mechanics and theme because I'm an amateur. But my favorite colors, I like white. I love white. And I just constructed a blue-red deck that I'm kind of happy with. It seems to be doing okay. But I really like blue. I like combining blue with other stuff. So I wouldn't, you know, I really wouldn't mind a blue-white deck, but I don't have enough cards to kind of share them around like that. So, but like I said, right now
I like blue because of its spells.
Yeah. I like, because I like the challenge of it because I'm not used to using spells so much. I'm used to playing creatures. I put stuff out on the field and I put stuff out on the field and then I run out of cards and I wind up, I like dipping into the blue and having some
dipping more into the blue. Did it.
The idea that I have the ability to start building up my hand again when I start running out of cards, that was novel to me. But again, I'm new at all of this. The number of times I've played Magic, I can almost count on my two hands, but it's a little bit more than that. But I'm still not very experienced at this at all. Next up is Sarah Beth, who is replying to Nelly. Says, I don't have anything to really add this week, so I'll just respond to my beloved Nelly instead. I love to play white with life gain and flyers, usually with blue or green. I avoid black unless I want to mess with Pat's head. Yeah, I don't care for the black at all. I do like the flyers, and I don't know what life gain is other than
I think it's life link or something that just gives you life.
Maybe
like providence, like makes you start off with 26 health.
Okay, I don't know anything about that. I like having white, and I like having flyers, and I have a whole bunch of cards in there that boost each other. So I don't have a whole bunch of really powerful cards, but you have a whole bunch of stuff where they work together to, oh, this one gives a +1/+1 to two other creatures. Oh, well, this card gives a +1/+1 to that. And eventually I've got +1/+1 markers on everybody, and I've built them all up from Midland to, Midland mediocre kind of guys to much more powerful. And, it requires getting them all on the damn field, but I like that style. I enjoy that. Nelly then says, replying to Sarah, neat. I don't really play anything competitive. I really just want to play a group hug deck at some point or arch enemy. My color is usually green or green white. Also cats for the win. Yeah, that's actually a good point because Nelly, just from what I know of you and the times I've gamed with you, I wouldn't expect you to be head to head competitive with Magic. But I'm glad to know that you enjoy it for what it is, to me, I don't care if I win or lose that much at Magic. Well, okay, I do, because I like winning, but that's not the important part of the game. The important part is just having a good time, and you don't ever seem to be ultra competitive in that way. So that is, I find that interesting. Very cool. Sarah Beth, yeah, cat decks forever. I have no idea what that means. I don't have any cats. I don't have any cats. It says cat. And then she says cat decks forever. That's what she wrote, man. I have no cats. I have a whale. I have one giant flying whale, and that's it. No cats. Pat says, apparently this is the all magic themed listener betrayal this week. Pat says, I am so glad Mike plays Magic now. Oh, how I want to wax poetic about the beauties of the color pie. Actually, oh man, this is a question I've been meaning to ask. Look, when I'm constructing my decks, I get that I need, the right proportion of land to the cards that I've got. And I think right now my white deck, as much as I like it, I think I'm a little heavy on the mana on this one. All right. I think I need to cut back. I think I put in 24, which was what was recommended, 40%. I have a straight 60 card deck. I don't go over. Straight 60 card deck. I went straight 40% on mana. And it seems like the last three games I've played, I have way too much mana out there. So I need to either cut back on the mana or I need to increase the number of powerful cards I have so I have more uses for that stuff. So I've got that balance that I'm working on. But then as I'm building up, I am, I am told that as I construct the deck, I'm looking at a pyramid of power here, so that, you know, there's a bell curve of the power level of your cards.
Like, you start off small with your wands, up at two or three.
Yeah, so you have a handful of cards that are only worth one, and then a bunch of cards at two and three, and then it starts to slope off at four, five, six, etc. And I keep meaning to ask you, Pat, I don't know where to put that pyramid. I know what feels right to me when I'm making it, but now I feel like I've shorted myself on powerful cards. But maybe I don't know. Like I said, I'm going a straight 60 card deck. Where do you cut them up? I know you have constructed a million decks, and you have good advice. I should have asked you sooner. So I'll bring this up on the boards, or you will once you hear this, because I really feel a little lost. I feel like I'm not doing my best job here. So I eagerly await advice. All right. Next up, Nelly replies to that and says, at Card Kingdom, where I work, we make these super awesome battle decks for like $10. And I was going to bring a few to Gen Con. I just got to figure out who's coming and who plays what, who plays and what they like. And then she offers a link to Card Kingdom. You guys should go check that out. And then Sarah Beth says, oh, making me wish I was coming more every day, y'all. Yeah, I'm sorry you're not going to be there, Sarah Beth. I mean, that's sad. I mean, you were the one that made all the plans. You reserved the hotel rooms. You did everything for us. And now you don't get to enjoy the fruits of your own labor. You have to live vicariously through Pat. That's, so sad. So sad. So, next year. You know what? We'll all make it next year. We'll make it up to you because you need to be there. So, anyway, done. We're all finished with this. So, say goodnight, Noah.
Good night.
Say goodnight, R2. Thank you so much, you guys, for everything. All the feedback's been great. Produce Farmer, thank you for the new Podomatics. I have been enjoying the crap out of this. It's a good episode. So I love you guys. I will see you next week. Be awesome. Oh, and don't forget, did I ever mention the, oh yeah, I did mention Adventures of Babysitting. Okay, thank God. Like, suddenly I blanked on it. But it's available on Netflix. So go watch Adventures in Babysitting and give me some feedback before next week's episode if you think about it. If you don't, that's cool, too. We're still going to cover it, and it's still going to be awesome. So, anyway, love you guys. Talk to you next week. Bye.